And I went through an argument to say that if there's some quantity which is zero in any coordinate system, then it's zero in all coordinate systems, right? If there's a tensor quantity. And that just follows because it transforms like a tensor. So, but nevertheless, I just want to point out the subtlety in this argument. You see, I pick a point in space-time. I pick coordinates at that point in which the derivatives of the metric are zero at that point. Okay? So all I've shown is that this quantity is zero at that point. Now I pick another point. Okay? I pick a different set of coordinates in which the metric is eta and the derivatives are zero at the new point in its coordinates. Okay? Then I do it again. Then I do it for all the points. So I've used an infinite number of coordinate systems, right? But in each one of those, this quantity was zero. And therefore, it's true that this quantity is zero in any coordinate system for the entire space-time. Okay, so it's a subtle argument, but it's a very powerful one. And we're going to use arguments like this during this lecture, too. So this lecture should be the culmination of the course. It'll all be downhill after here. because we have now climbed the mountain of differential geometry, and we're going to, I hope, write down the Einstein equations in this lecture, which are probably the greatest achievement of physics to discover the equations for space, time, and the universe. Of course, at the time, Einstein had no idea his equations would describe the universe. He was just trying to make a theory of Newtonian gravity, which was consistent with relativity. So it's really an amazing achievement, and I hope you'll see that it justifies all those horrible indices and all the algebra you have to do. So we're going to talk about the curvature of space-time. And I've already indicated that is described by Riemann's tensor, discovered in the early 19th century. And the basic idea, as I mentioned at the end of last time, is that whereas partial derivatives commute, these covariant derivatives, the ones where I had to add in the connection in order to make sure this was still a tensor, these covariant derivatives do not commute. So in particular, we can take the commutator of two covariant derivatives on a four-vector rho, and now, you might say, why am I taking a four-vector? Why don't I just take a scalar over there? If I took a scalar, it would be zero. Okay, we can check that easily enough. You see, if I did a scalar minus d nu d mu s, okay, covariant derivative on a scalar is the same as ordinary derivative, right? So these guys I can just replace by partial. There's no connection that appears for a scalar. Okay, and now when I write this down, there are two terms. There's a partial derivative, which commutes, so I can ignore that term. And then there's a connection term. Okay, so this term is going to give me, it's going to give me d mu d nu minus, because the downstairs index, gamma nu mu lambda d lambda, right, acting on s. Okay, so this term will cancel by antisymmetry with that term. And over here, I'm just going to get the same thing, but with mu replaced by nu. So I'm going to get gamma nu mu lambda minus gamma mu nu lambda times d lambda s. Okay, but this gamma object, the way I've defined it, is symmetrical under mu and nu, and so this is zero. Okay, so for scalars, we wouldn't get anything interesting. Now, actually, that's an opportune moment for me to mention that the whole way I derived gamma, it came out symmetric. That's because I derived it via the G. Dzik equation. There is a generalization of gamma, which is possible, which is to add an anti-symmetric piece to gamma called a torsion. All right, and we may talk about this later. In fact, that torsion piece is necessary in order to, well, it's not necessary, but it usually occurs in theories with spinning particles. If you have spin half particles in particular, when you write the Dirac equation in curved spacetime and you write down some Lagrangian that includes fermion fields, you generally find there's torsion. So theories like supergravity or string theory generally have torsion. They have an anti-symmetric part to this connection. Okay, but that's a complication. It's dealt with rather nicely in that the book by Houston and Todd. The way I've introduced things, because I tried to be as simple as possible, the torsion never entered. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Sorry, what's the question? No, it's not strictly necessary. It is necessary for supersymmetry.
Right.
If you write a supersymmetric Lagrangian, right, in general there'd be torsion. And so one way of saying it is that many theories with fermions will have torsion.
Okay.
It's not demanded.
Right.
If you put in some other space-time symmetries like supersymmetry, then torsion arises. When it arises, it's always minuscule, and therefore makes very little difference to measurements. Hi, Mike. Thanks. As you, when we do that, this guy is. Okay. All right. No problem. Okay, I'll just I'll try and avoid using it.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Okay. I'm a theorist. I have this effect. I'm fairly notorious for things failing in my presence. Okay. Right. So if we assumed gamma was symmetric, as well, I derived gamma that way from the G. Dzik equation, then commutator of covariant derivatives is zero on a scalar, right, by symmetry of gamma. So, next best thing is to take a vector, take the commutator of two covariant derivatives on a vector, and this is in fact how Riemann discovered the Riemann curvature. Left-hand side of the equation is clearly a tensor, so the right-hand side must be, and it's a tensor for any vector field S. And so, in fact, there's a theorem called the quotient theorem, which is not hard to prove. If some quantity minded multiplied by a vector is a tensor for all vectors S lambda, then A mu mu lambda is a tensor. Okay, so Riemann figured out this quotient theorem. He knew the left-hand side is a tensor for any S. The right-hand side is a tensor for any S. Therefore, the right-hand side is a tensor for any S. And since that is true, this coefficient must be a tensor. So now we're going to calculate this. So there's a little bit of boring algebra. I'll try and avoid using that that one. So let's just calculate the left-hand side. So this is d mu, d nu s rho minus gamma rho nu sigma s sigma minus gamma nu mu alpha d alpha s rho minus gamma rho alpha gamma s gamma minus gamma alpha rho mu d nu s alpha minus gamma alpha nu sigma s sigma. All of that, okay, that's the first term on the left-hand side, because the stuff inside the brackets is the nu derivative, and the outer stuff is the mu derivative, right? The partial derivative, the two connections, because this guy has two indices. And then I take all that and I subtract off mu going to nu. Now, some terms are obviously zero when I subtract off the mu to nu. In particular, this guy's symmetric under mu goes to nu, right? This term is symmetric. So this one is just going to cancel with the same term over there. The whole of this bracket, okay, is going to cancel all of this term. So let's look, secondly, this term is going to cancel. This partial derivative, okay, is going to cancel. Likewise, will also cancel. Let's underline it to make sure it's the whole term. And so what are we left with? Well, the sort of nasty terms are the ones involving the derivatives of S. So let's try and collect those. So I've got minus gamma rho nu sigma d mu S sigma coming from here. And then I've got a derivative of S from here minus gamma rho mu alpha d nu S alpha from there. And let's stare at that for a minute. What do you notice about it? Any symmetries? How's this term related to that term?
You have the same change in mu and nu.
Brilliant. It's symmetric under mu exchanges with nu, right?
Where's sigma on the second term?
That's sigma.
Right.
It's a repeated index. Yep. So it doesn't really matter if it's sigma or alpha.
Yep.
It doesn't matter. Okay, so this is symmetric under mu goes to nu. Right? But over here, I subtract off mu goes to nu. So this cancels. All right, so cancels. With the minus mu goes to nu term. And that's basically it. Okay, we're done. All we have here, we get equal minus d mu gamma rho nu sigma from the first term. Here we get plus gamma rho mu alpha m gamma alpha nu sigma s sigma minus mu to nu. I've lost a sigma somewhere. Okay, and we have this result. So it follows that the quantity I called R, sigma rho mu nu, is equal to d mu gamma mu nu sigma minus d nu gamma rho mu sigma minus gamma rho mu alpha gamma alpha nu sigma plus gamma rho nu alpha gamma sigma alpha mu. Let's check that. Sorry? Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so I'm just so this term becomes that term. And then I just subtract off the same thing with mu goes to nu to get this term. And then this term becomes that term. It's a minus sign because in the definition of the equation I put a minus. Oh, too many alphas. Thank you. Yeah, good. You're getting good at this. Okay? If you see three repeated indices, you know something is wrong. Okay, indices have to match on both sides of a tensor equation. And summed indices don't count. Okay, so that is the Riemann tensor. And now we're going to make one of these locally flat arguments. Okay, in a locally flat coordinate system, gamma mu alpha beta equals zero. Okay, so that means for some point, I pick a locally flat coordinate system at that point, and in those coordinates, gamma equals zero at that point, because gamma only involves first derivatives of a metric. But the derivatives of gamma don't vanish, and so let's calculate. Let's calculate the derivative. So d mu gamma rho nu sigma is equal to, so let's just recall the definition of gamma. Gamma alpha beta was this guy. Mu, what do I call it? Lambda g alpha lambda beta plus g beta lambda alpha minus g mu lambda beta. What am I talking about? Alpha, beta, lambda. So in a flat coordinate system, the derivatives of the metric vanish. But let's take a second derivative, the derivatives of gamma, which involve second derivatives of the metric. Now, in the flat coordinate system, this is going to reduce to eta mu nu. Well, actually, no, it's simpler to say. When I differentiate the gamma, and then say I'm in a flat coordinate system, the derivatives of this guy are zero. Okay? You might worry, g alpha beta lambda equals zero. What about g alpha beta lambda with raised indices? Okay, well, this is just the inverse of that matrix. And if you have an inverse, you know, g alpha beta, g beta delta, by definition, that's delta alpha delta. If I differentiate this equation, it will give me a relationship between the derivative of the inverse and the derivative of the original g. And that relationship is just that g inverse alpha is equal to minus g inverse, g comma alpha here. I think you've done that in the tutorial. So if the derivative of g is 0, then the derivative of g inverse is also 0. So when I compute this derivative of gamma, the only terms that are non-zero are these ones. And in locally flat coordinates. And so this is equal to eta sigma lambda. So in locally flat coordinates. Okay, where g is eta, derivatives of g are 0. Now we need the second derivatives of g. And they come from differentiating those terms. So I get g rho lambda mu nu plus g nu lambda rho mu minus g rho nu lambda mu. Okay, I hope that that is correct. Mm-hmm. So that's the first derivative of gamma at the point. And then obviously we're going to use that to construct the Riemann tensor using this formula. So we just ignore these last two terms, they're both zero. And then use this expression for the derivatives of gamma. And what I get is r sigma rho mu nu is equal to 1 half g sigma lambda. That's now eta sigma lambda. And then g nu lambda comma rho mu. You see, a term like this will give 0 because it's symmetric under mu and nu. It's just partial derivatives of mu and nu. So this one cancels. This one gets should get doubled. Oh, I've got that half in there. Should get doubled. Sorry, the half is correct. There are four terms. So this one, I'll need to subtract the same version with mu goes to nu. So that's just given by g. Oh, let's write the whole thing down. Lambda mu, and now I subtract this guy with mu goes to nu. So that should be g mu lambda rho nu, and then I subtract this whole thing with mu goes to nu, so that means a plus g rho mu comma lambda nu. And then just to make it look nicer, let me lower the sigma index. So with all four indices lowered, it's equal to, so I lower the sigma index, and this guy becomes sigma, g nu sigma rho mu minus g rho nu comma sigma mu minus g mu sigma rho nu plus g rho mu sigma nu. Now, why did I go through all that? The reason is because in this form, it's easy to read off all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. Okay, the symmetries of Riemann. You see, and a symmetry, so what is a symmetry? A symmetry is a statement like a mu nu equals a nu mu. That would be a symmetry of, that's saying the tensor is symmetric, okay? But that itself is a tensor equation, okay? So if I work it out in one coordinate, if I prove it's true in one coordinate system, okay, it's true in any coordinate system. So if I discover some symmetries of the Riemann tensor in locally flat coordinates at one point, then they're true in any coordinates at that point. And since I could do it at every point, it must be true in every coordinate system at every point. Okay, so we're just using that same old argument. So the first one is that you see, the only symmetry that was obvious from its definition was this anti-symmetry under mu and nu. Okay, so by definition, this R is anti-symmetric under the last two indices. Yeah, these two terms are just the negative of the first two terms, just flipped to mu and nu. But there are other symmetries which become clear when you write it this way. And rho mu nu. So the first one is, let me describe them in words. One symmetric under interchange of first and last pair of indices. Okay, so that means if I take the first two indices and replace them with second two indices and vice versa, this is symmetric. Okay, R sigma rho mu nu equals R mu nu sigma rho. Okay, so I won't check it, but I'll just leave it to you to check that. That if I take this expression and I replace sigma with mu, rho with nu with sigma, nu with rho, then it's exactly the same. It's unchanged. Secondly, this anti-symmetry of the last two indices extends to an anti-symmetry of the first two indices. Not really surprising, because you could flip the first and the second pairs of indices. So under exchanging the first two indices, or the last two, last two indices. Okay, so that means R rho sigma R sigma rho mu nu. I guess I'm always writing it that way. Let me write it, continue that. Sigma rho mu nu is equal to minus R rho sigma mu nu. So I just flipped the first and second indices. It's also equal to minus R sigma rho nu mu, where I flipped the last two indices. And it's, of course, equal to plus, if I flip both of them, rho sigma, rho sigma nu mu. So it has some symmetry and some anti-symmetry. Just try to put this one up a bit. And finally, it has a property called cyclicity. And cyclicity means that I take sigma rho mu nu. And cyclicity means I just cycle the last three indices. Okay, cyclicity, which applies to the last three indices. So what that means is that I just cycle these three indices around. So I say it's plus sigma nu rho mu, bring the last one to the front. And then I bring the last one to the front again, sigma mu sigma rho. And this combination is zero. Okay, so those of you who are familiar with algebras, and maybe you did Lie algebras earlier in this course, you may recognize this as the Jacobi identity. And actually, that's where it comes from. It follows from, you can prove it either from this expression, just in the boring way, or you can realize that actually these covariant derivatives, because they form an algebra, it just means they can be multiplied, that these the commutator of a commutator obeys this Jacobi identity, where I just cycle the indices d lambda, d mu, d nu, plus d nu, d lambda, d mu equals 0, which is the Jacobi identity. And the proof of that identity is totally trivial. Just write out all the terms. Okay? Write out all the terms and you'll find they all cancel. So, so we have this Riemann tensor. And it has these nice symmetries. And so I don't know why I did that. It always goes the wrong way first time. The blackboard does not obey cyclicity. It likes to permute one these two, and then it cycles. I don't know what it's doing, but it's not cyclic. So question. How many independent components are there in the Riemann tensor? Okay, we know that in antisymmetric two-index tensor, there are 6 components in 4 dimensions. In a symmetric one, there are 10 components, like the metric. The metric has 10 independent components. In a tensor with no symmetry, it's got 16 components. 2x2 tensor. Now we're into this 4-index tensor, which is a bit scary. So obviously in 4 dimensions, naively, the Riemann tensor has 4 times 4 times 4 times 4. Which is a lot of indices, okay? But let us do it in d dimensions, just because we can, and it will be instructive. And now we have to figure out how to take account of all these symmetries, which reduce the number of independent components. So let's. Let's take 1 and 2 into account. So first, take 1 and 2 into account. Okay, so basically we can think of this 4-index object as a matrix that has 2 indices, but each index is a pair of indices, okay, of d-dimensional indices. Okay, so in d dimensions, so think of R mu nu rho lambda as a symmetric matrix okay, where this is one matrix index and that's the other matrix index, because when I interchange those two, it's symmetric. Okay, so then all I need to know is how many values does this index take? Well, it's antisymmetric under mu exchange with nu. So each index takes d minus 1 over 2 values. Okay, because it's antisymmetric under mu and nu. So there are d ways of getting mu, and then only d minus 1 ways of getting nu will give a non-zero value. Because of the antisymmetry, I divide by 2. So taking 1 and 2 into account, what I get is d minus 1 over 2 multiplied by d minus 1 over 2 plus 1. That's the number of independent components of a symmetric matrix in a dimension given by d minus 1 over 2. So, I need to multiply this by half, right? So for a symmetric matrix AAB in n dimensions, you'd say it's n plus 1 over 2 independent components. So this is the n, and that's the number of independent components when I've taken the symmetries 1 and 2 into account. And if we just work this out, it turns out it's 1/8 d minus 1 d squared minus d plus 2. Okay, I just kept this factor out the front and worked out this stuff in brackets. Now we've got to take the cyclicity into account. Be very sneaky. And use this one. Okay, so the cyclicity. Now, this cyclicity is an equation. And the thing about it is an equation which is totally antisymmetric under the exchange of any two indices. Okay, so let's imagine we exchange nu and rho. Well, this guy's antisymmetric, so this one changes to minus itself. If I exchange nu and rho, this term will go to r sigma rho nu mu, okay? But then if I flip the mu and nu, it goes to this one with the minus sign. Then if I exchange nu and rho in this term, I'll need to do one flip of indices, and I'll get that one with a minus sign. Okay, so this equation is completely antisymmetric under exchange of any pair of indices. Okay, it's a beautiful property. And what it means is there's only a limited number of equations there. There are, i.e., it's the number of components of a completely antisymmetric four-index tensor over 4-factorial equations. Okay, so that you might naively say that was d to the power 4 equations, okay? But because of this antisymmetry, it's not that many equations. There are only this many independent components of the equation. And so this is the number of equations represented by the cyclicity constraint. So the number of independent components of Riemann taking all these symmetries into account. Is 1/8 d d minus 1 d squared minus d plus 2 minus the number of constraints represented by cyclicity d d minus 1 d minus 2 d minus 3 over 4 factorial. And that's equal to d squared over 12, d squared minus 1. And the reason I write the exclamation mark is that, if you remember, you probably don't, but we argued that that was precisely the number of second derivatives of the metric tensor which could not be set 0 by a coordinate transformation, right? I.e., it magically equals the number of second derivatives of the metric tensor, which cannot be set 0. Zero at a point by a coordinate transformation. Okay, so when Riemann discovered this, he must have been pretty happy. He realized he'd found a coordinate independent description of curvature in terms of a tensor. And then, as I've mentioned before, from the Riemann tensor, everything else follows. All the other tensors that we'll need in general relativity. So, just to remind you, from this, from Riemann, we can form other tensors, namely the Ricci tensor, which is R sigma nu, which is R rho sigma rho nu. So I contract the first and third indices of Riemann, and I get a symmetric tensor. It's symmetric because when I exchange the first two and the last two indices of Riemann, it's symmetric. And then I can also form the Ricci scalar, which has no indices, and I just use the metric there to contract the metric with Ricci, which is the same as raising one index of Ricci and contracting it with the other. So if you read the correspondence between Einstein and Hilbert and all the other people who were thinking about this problem in the 1910s, it's very funny because it's full of equations like this. How many components? There's dd minus 1 times d minus 3. And no, you've got d minus 4 over. It's all arguments about the d's. But Hilbert, probably one of the most prominent mathematicians of the time, of course, knew all this. And when he realized that Einstein's trying to connect Riemannian geometry with gravity, Hilbert knew, for example, that if you want to write down an action principle, which is invariant under general coordinates, there's really only one candidate, or almost only one candidate, okay, which is this guy. And so straight away you could say, well, if there's going to be an action for gravity, it has to be the only possible. So the point is that there is only one scalar quantity representing the intrinsic curvature of a manifold. And that's the Ricci scalar.
If you want the second order
equation. Yes, true. The only possible action, which is of course second order in derivatives, okay, that's a basic assumption of mechanics and dynamics going all the way back to Newton, that the action should involve second derivatives only, not third or fourth or fourth or fifth derivatives. But if you restrict to second derivatives only, there's really only one possible action, and that would be integral d4x, integral over space-time, this root minus g. So as we discussed last time, this is coordinate invariant. Invariant. Okay, basically because the d4x, if I go to d4x prime, that's given by the Jacobian matrix. So d4x is equal to dx prime dx, the determinant of this matrix transformation. And of course we've got the g prime, the metric transforms as dx dx prime, dx dx prime times g. So the determinant of g prime is this Jacobian matrix, dx dx prime squared times the determinant of g. And so you see if I take the square root of det g, I get the Jacobian dx dx prime. But that precisely cancels the Jacobian of dx prime dx. Okay, so this quantity is coordinate invariant, and then r, which is a scalar. And therefore, also coordinate invariant. So that's the action for gravity. And indeed, that turned out to be correct. I want to mention another tensor, which is useful. I'll do it over here. So I think I mentioned earlier in the course about conformal symmetry, which is also a symmetry of Maxwell's theory. It's a symmetry under scale change, so there is no fundamental scale in Maxwell's theory. For studying conformal symmetry, there's another tensor which is very useful called the Weyl tensor. And in the context of general relativity, this Weyl tensor essentially also describes gravitational waves, like light waves. And the Weyl tensor is formed the following way. So it's really just a rewriting of the Riemann tensor. But it's defined as follows, and I'll tell you why in a moment. So this is equal to the Riemann tensor with a whole bunch of terms involving Ricci, g mu sigma r nu rho plus g nu rho r mu sigma minus g nu sigma r rho mu minus g mu rho r mu sigma. Doesn't end there. Keeps going. B minus 1, B minus 2. G mu rho g nu sigma minus g nu rho g mu sigma multiplied by r. So the vowel tensor is also second order in derivatives of the metric. And the reason we took all this, these funny combinations of Riemann and Ricci is that this has the property that it is traceless on all pairs of indices. I.e., C mu rho sigma equals zero, etc. Okay, so the Riemann tensor is not traceless. Traceless means that if I contract two pairs of indices. Now, to contract them, I've got to raise one with the metric and then sum over the pair. Okay, so Riemann is not traceless. In fact, its trace gives the Ricci tensor. Trace on the first and third indices gives the Ricci tensor. And the trace of the Ricci tensor gives the Ricci scalar. So that suggests, well, let's take Riemann and take out the traces. Form some tensor that's completely traceless on all indices. It's trivially traceless on these two or those two because anti-symmetric. Okay, but tracing it on one of the first pair and one of the second pairs, it's not zero. So you take out all the traces. And so this vowel tensor has fewer components than Riemann. In fact, the number of components of independent components would be however many the Riemann had, which I've forgotten. Where is it? Was it written somewhere? Maybe I erased it. D squared over 12, d squared minus 1, minus the number of components of Ricci. Now, Ricci is just d plus 1 over 2, right? That's a Ricci tensor. It's a symmetric tensor. And the Ricci scalar comes from the so this hopefully is, must admit I didn't check this. This is d minus 1, d plus 1 times d minus 1 over 6 minus 1. And that should be an integer if I did my algebra correctly. I'll leave it to you to check. All right. So the vowel tensor represents the sort of trace-free part of the curvature.
One question.
Yeah.
What if we wanted to calculate the vowel tensor in, say, two dimensions? Should we just neglect the last
Yeah, two, the good question. Terms? So we didn't go through this, but let's go back to the Riemann. Before we do that, number of components, we actually did this earlier, but of Riemann. And let's do Ricci, and let's do Weyl. Okay, so in D dimensions, let's go through the D. So D could be 1, 2, 3, 4. Riemann in one dimension, zero components, right? One dimension is flat, has no intrinsic curvature. We saw that. You always pick coordinates in which it's just a straight line. It's just a line. Two dimensions, So this better be an integer. 4 times 3 over 12 is an integer, so it's 1. In three dimensions, 9 times 8 over 12 is how many?
6.
Pardon?
6 unless it screwed up.
Right. 9 times 8 over 12 is 6. Okay, so Riemann has 6 components. In 4 dimensions, 16 times 15 over 12 is 20. Okay. What about Ricci? Well, Ricci is a symmetric tensor. Okay, so that should be dd plus 1 over 2. So this should be 1. Dd plus 1 over 2. It's symmetric. 1. But Riemann, well, it would be 1, but except it comes from here. Okay. And this quantity is 0. So this doesn't count. Okay? If you just took it at face value as a symmetric tensor, it would have one component, R11. But actually, R11 is the trace of this guy, which is 0. So, 0. Two dimensions. I think you have to make the same argument that the Ricci tensor comes from Riemann. Riemann only really has one component. So in two dimensions, let's write it down. It's pretty obvious there's only one component because it's got to be anti-symmetric under the first two indices, anti-symmetric under the last two indices. So these have to be different. It's got to be symmetric under exchanging them. So there's only this index. And that happens to be the Ricci. That the Ricci would be R1. One Ricci would be would have to be no that can't, that doesn't exist. R1. Yeah, I'm not going to try and write it down. Okay, so this will just be 1 as well. The Weyl tensor in two dimensions. Well, you see, this expression doesn't make any sense. And you might already guess that the Ricci tensor is already traceless on any two indices in two dimensions. Okay, so there's nothing really to take out. It's already traceless. Why is that? Well, let me see if I can show that. So in two dimensions, yes, we have this R. So the trace would be G rho sigma. It must follow from the symmetry rho sigma mu nu. And so we're just going to calculate G11, G12, G22. Let me just invite you to do that, okay? And see that the trace on all indices is identically 0. Is identically 0. So that's why the Weyl tensor doesn't exist in this form, in two dimensions. And then if we go up to three dimensions, we can try and figure out how does this 6 split in... So how does it split into Ricci and Weyl? I believe that in three dimensions, the Weyl tensor is identically 0. Yeah. So in three dimensions, everything is in Ricci. Okay. And this Weyl tensor is identically 0. As, if I take this definition and I calculate it, then you'll just discover that in three dimensions, it's identically 0. Okay, so here it is identically 0. And in four dimensions, the Ricci has 10 components because it is a 4x4 symmetric matrix, right? So it has 4 times 5 over 2, which is 10 components. And the Weyl tensor has 10 components. Any other questions? Yeah.
So I understand why we can make this traceless Weyl tensor, but what's the significance of it being traceless?
Yes, I should have. Well, there are a couple of significances which are a little hard for me to justify. One significance is that when we study gravitational waves, it'll turn out that the gravitational waves are, if you think about metric perturbations, the metric is perturbation is this h mu nu. Essentially, the gravitational waves are the traceless perturbations of h. And if you go to try to represent the gravitational waves non-linearly, the Weyl tensor is what does it. That's a very rough explanation. So roughly speaking, you can think of the components of the Ricci tensor as being coupled to the matter. The matter stress tensor, T mu nu, has 10 components. These 10 components get linked to the matter directly. The other 10 describe things that don't depend on the matter. They're like nonlinear gravitational waves. That's a very, very rough analogy. So one way in which the Weyl tensor is useful is in describing gravitational radiation. The other way, one useful in describing gravitational radiation. And two, it has the very nice property that if I change the metric, if g prime mu nu of x prime, actually just of x, is equal to omega squared of x, g mu nu of x. Okay, so that's a funny transformation. What does it represent? It means a change in scale. That I have a metric, I use it to measure length, and then at every space-time point, I multiply the metric by an arbitrary positive function. That means that I'm stretching the space or shrinking the space according to this quantity, so I change the definition of scale. So that is called a Weyl transformation. And you know, when Einstein wrote down his theory of gravity, Weyl said, that's all very well, but it doesn't sound right to me because you've got a scale. And the scale turned out to be Newton's constant. That's the length scale in Einstein's gravity. Physicists were happy with that, but Weyl was a mathematician, and he said, that's really ugly. Why should the fundamental description of space-time have a scale? And so he said, it would be much better if your theory was invariant, not just under local coordinate transformations, but if it was invariant under scale change as well. And so that's still a very appealing idea. And the reason the Weyl tensor is useful is this Weyl tensor transforms simply under these changes. And let's see if I can remember the right power of omega. The point is, yeah, I can think of this as being two derivatives acting on, so I believe it's just omega squared c. I think. Okay, it transforms covariantly under Weyl transformations. So if you go to this bigger symmetry, we're always looking for things which are invariant under the symmetry or covariant under the symmetry because we like to write our equations in a form which is valid, whichever symmetry, an equation which is valid, which is obviously invariant under symmetry transformations, and the Weyl tensor is the most, it is the quantity that transforms covariantly under Weyl transformations. Any other questions? Okay, so let me move on because I want to get to Einstein's equations. And so we're going to do that now. Now I'm in trouble. So I better use this one. So we're going to, I have to tell you one other thing before we do that. Tell you one more thing, and I've lost my page which does it. let me just see. Okay, I'll have to do it in real time. So, the Einstein equation. Einstein equations. So, Einstein wanted to write an equation down which coupled the curvature of space-time to the curvature of space-time to, let me not even write that down. The curvature of space-time, r rho sigma mu nu, would be related to the stress energy in space-time. So Einstein knew that energy distorts space-time, so he wants to write down an equation which relates these two quantities. Okay? So, his first attempt, so this is space-time, and this is energy. To understand how energy bends space-time. Okay, so he knows I've got to write down an equation which is invariant under general coordinate transformations. This doesn't make any sense because it has the wrong number of indices. So the obvious thing to do is to contract some of them. And so we can form the Ricci tensor. That's a symmetric 4x4 tensor. And actually, Einstein's first guess for these equations was that r mu nu equals constant times t mu nu. That turned out to be wrong. Okay, it's another mistake Einstein made, but along the right track, because he forgot that you can actually write down another tensor, which is g mu nu r, which is also symmetric 4x4 tensor. And that should somehow be related to t mu nu, okay? So he wants to write down an equation in which I have r mu nu plus some constant alpha times g mu nu r equals some constant, let me call this one a maybe, equal to b times t mu nu, right? With a and b constants. So how am I going to determine A and B? Well, one very important property, so the key property of t mu nu of T min u is that it is conserved. Okay, which means that the covariant derivative of T min u equals zero. We only discussed this in special relativity where I showed the ordinary derivative was zero. But when you lift it to a curved spacetime, that ordinary derivative has to become a covariant derivative if the equation is going to be valid in all coordinate systems. And so this is what it must be. And so what you want is a combination of r mu nu and r, which satisfies this property. Then this equation will be consistent. Okay, so it turns out, I can try and prove it if we have time at the end, that from the cyclicity of the Riemann tensor, it turns out. Okay. It turns out that the covariant derivative of r mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu r equals zero identically. Okay, this follows from an identity called the Bianchi identity. And I will show this, since we're a little short of time this time, I will show this next time. And also, I didn't bring my notes. So Einstein initially made this error of assuming the left-hand side of the Einstein equation was just r mu nu, and then he realized he had to correct it by subtracting 1/2 g mu nu r, and so the quantity this quantity is known as the Einstein tensor. So it's just a linear combination of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar times the metric. So we must have G mu nu equals B T mu nu with B a constant. So all we have to do is work out the constant. And we'll do that in the weak field limit. We can work out the constant in the weak field, in other words, Newtonian limit. By weak field, I just mean that h mu nu is less than 1. G mu nu is eta mu nu plus h mu nu, and modulus of h mu nu is less than 1, much less than 1. So we can work out the constant in this weak field limit. So all we do is work out the Riemann tensor in that limit. R sigma rho mu kappa is equal to, I can use my expression, unfortunately I've rubbed it out, involving derivatives of the metric. Notice that if G is eta plus H, gamma goes like H, because gamma depends on derivatives. So the gamma-gamma terms in the Riemann tensor are of order H squared, and you can forget about them. The terms involving G inverse are, you know, 1 plus H. So basically, everything only comes from the second derivatives of H. And it's easy to derive this formula just from the equations I gave you before. Rho nu sigma mu minus H mu sigma rho nu plus H rho mu sigma nu plus order H squared. And so from this expression, you can see that our we now want to construct the Ricci tensor. So to get the Ricci tensor, and furthermore, so we need the 0,0 component of the Ricci tensor. Okay, because that's going to be equal to T0,0 times a constant, where T0,0 is the energy density. Okay, so R0,0, well, that comes from R rho 0 rho 0. And so that involves a contraction, the 0,0 contraction, R0,0,0. Plus ri, 0i0, where i goes from 1 to 3. But you know, when we do this weak field approximation, we raise and lower indices with eta, which is diagonal. So this guy is just minus r0,0,0. But that, of course, is 0. It's 0 just by anti-symmetry. And so the only term we need is actually coming from here. This term, to get this, well, this is easy to calculate, and it comes from minus half h. It's half h 0, 0. I. So let me just show you that. if I want to calculate the 0,0 component of Ricci, I'm going to contract sigma with mu. I'm going to assume a static metric, assuming, as before, that d by dx 0 of h mu nu equals 0. So I can ignore time derivatives. So when I work out this guy, I0, I0 is what I need. And so rho and kappa would both be 0. Anything involving a derivative with respect to 0 is 0. So anything with a rho derivative or a kappa derivative, I've got my indices wrong here. Sigma, not kappa. Sorry, eta. Nu, not kappa. That should be nu. Anything involving a rho derivative or a nu derivative should be 0. So this is 0. This is 0. This is 0. The only non-zero term is this one. And you see I get minus a half. H00, comma, II, which is here. Okay, but we already worked out the relationship between H00 and the Newtonian potential, phi. And if you remember, for static gravitational fields, we had this relationship that H00 was minus 2 phi over c squared, where phi is the Newtonian potential. So this quantity here is twice Laplacian times phi over c squared. So that's the left-hand side of the Einstein equations. Okay, well, that's the zero component of the left-hand side of the Einstein equations. Zero, zero component. And on the right-hand side, I have T zero, zero. So the Einstein equation reads R00, I've got to work out the Ricci scalar. Let's work that out as well. The Ricci scalar, which is R0000 plus RI0I0 plus R0I0I plus RIJIJ. As we've argued, this is zero. These two terms add, and so what I end up with is minus H00, II, and this term does not depend on H00. Okay, so the second and third terms give you that quantity. And so the Einstein equation reads R00. Where is the Einstein equation? Remember, G mu is R mu minus 1/2. Here it is. Okay, so the Einstein equations are R mu minus 1/2 G mu equals constant times T mu. Just take the 0, 0 component of that equation, R 0, 0 minus 1/2 eta 0, 0 times R. See, R is of order H. So I can replace G with eta plus H and drop the H term. That would be H squared, B T naught naught. Eta naught naught is minus 1. So that's what it reads. And if we add these two terms together, R00 plus 1/2 R, this combination is minus H minus Laplacian H00, which equals plus 2 del squared phi over c squared, since we know that H naught naught is the Newtonian potential, or minus 2 phi over c squared. Okay, so that's the left-hand side. And then it's equal to some constant times T00. But we know what T00 is. T00 is the energy density. Okay, but in Newton's theory, everything depended only on the mass density. So you're supposed to take the energy density and divide by c squared. This will be the mass density. This is rho mass times c squared. That's the energy density, right? Because E equals mc squared. So from this, but we know from Poisson that del squared phi is 4 pi g rho mass. Okay, so we must have that B is equal to 8 over c, 8 pi g over c to the fourth. And so the Einstein equations are that the Einstein tensor is 8 pi g t mu nu over c to the fourth, where g is Newton's constant. Let's just quickly check dimensions, always a good idea. And especially since I left the C's in there and everything, it should be easy to check dimensions. So what is the dimensions of T, T naught naught, where I already said this is the energy density. So this should be the mass density times C squared. G, so this should be a mass over a volume, okay, times C squared. And of course, g times the mass over a length. So if I multiply t naught naught by g, I can use this formula. The gm over a length goes like a velocity squared, right? Just by v squared is gm over r for a circular orbit. So the right-hand side, RHS goes like c squared times some velocity squared, right, over c to the fourth. C squared, so times 1 over L squared. This is all dimensionless, right? So the right-hand side has dimensions of 1 over length to the fourth. That's what a curvature should be. A curvature is the second derivative. The metric is always dimensionless. The curvature is two derivatives, so curvature goes like 1 over length squared. So the left-hand side goes like 1 over length squared because two derivatives. Good. So it's dimensionally correct. And that was Einstein's great discovery. Any questions? Are you overawed? You should be. Yeah.
So when he was thinking about the equations, he wanted to make the Riemann tensor proportional, or something that comes from the Riemann tensor proportional to T mu.
Yes.
And since the number of indices didn't match, he contracted the indices here. But couldn't he alternatively have added indices to the other side by multiplying it to G, T by G or T by R mu nu, and make like an equation with like both sides having four indices?
I see. So you're saying, could I do that?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no, because I mean, it's a good idea, but the problem is this guy's anti-symmetric under these two indices, whereas this side is symmetric.
Mm-hmm.
So the symmetries just won't work unless I contract the Riemann tensor and get a symmetric thing which has the same symmetries as T.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thought, but I don't think it will work.
Yeah.
You've got to write down some equation which is supposed to be generally valid. It should respect all the symmetries which are general. So the one thing I haven't proven to you is this identity that the covariant derivative of the Einstein tensor is zero. I'll do that first thing next time. Yeah.
So in like the Maxwell theory, this grad mu T mu nu will like the divergence-free stress energy tensor. That's not always true. In the Maxwell theory, if you have a source, is that still always zero?
Oh, good question. This equation has to hold for the combined stress energy of everything.
Okay. Right.
So Maxwell, on its own, satisfies this equation. If I couple Maxwell to a source, then the Maxwell on its own doesn't satisfy it anymore. But the combination of the stress energy of Maxwell and the source will satisfy it.
Oh, the source is like some matter.
Yeah, exactly. So the only T mu nu's we've talked about so far are T mu nu for Maxwell, which went like FF, various indices, right? And then for particles, it went like integral x dot mu times some four-dimensional delta function. And this guy is the stress energy of a particle, which couples to Maxwell. And this combination will satisfy d mu equals zero, if you take everything into account.
Is there like any...
Then there's also a coupling term. This is the stress energy of the free particles. And then I also told you there was this coupling term, right? X dot mu a mu. And it's only when you consider, in fact, this one is more to the point, because this depends on the charge of the particles. So when a very a mu, this is in the action. Okay, I'm confusing things. This is in the action. So in the stress energy, that will also contribute a term, which will look like, this. A new. This is the current times the A. Okay, so basically, Maxwell with the source looks like this. Equals J nu, and then the term in the stress energy will go like the vector potential times J nu. And that has to be added in, and only if you add that in will the whole thing be.
So I guess what I originally wanted to ask was, I mean, I've seen this argument before about, oh, well, we just kind of want both sides to be divergent degrees, so we're going to throw this guy in here, or whatever,
yeah,
like that extra term, and get the Einstein tensor.
Yeah.
But what would make it so, like, what rules out the possibility of just having some analogous kind of source term that would, do you understand what it
is? Yeah,
means?
I do understand. I mean, the sort of cheesy argument is to say, whatever doesn't satisfy that will combine into T mu nu. Okay. So if I've got some other piece here, look, for this to be a consistent equation, if the left-hand side is divergence free, the right-hand side has
absolutely
to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So now you say, well, imagine I've got some quantity whose is not divergence free. You know, well, I can't write this equation down. So my only hope for writing a consistent equation, put something on the right-hand side, which is covariantly constant. What else would you think of adding?
No, I guess what I mean is the initial argument usually.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's exactly what you were saying. Maybe I misunderstood. But people usually say, oh well, if T mu nu is going to be divergence free, they start with this assumption and they say,
oh,
well, then
see.
We better add this thing to make G mu nu.
Fine.
Like that's why you arrive at G mu nu to make.
Yes, it's a bit of a shortcut. Okay, the argument, because you're saying. T mu nu by definition is something which is divergence free. I mean that's a little mysterious.
Yeah.
You know, why did you say the matter that's described by something, matter only couples to gravity through something which is divergence free? That's the assumption. Okay, so it's a big assumption. Okay. Now the better way of thinking about it is to think about the action. Okay, and that's why this Einstein tensor, that's really its origin. So in this way of doing it, the Einstein tensor was sort of the combination of R mu nu and R, which is divergence free. If we start instead from the action, and we say we would like the equations to come from an action, that's the only thing it can be. When you vary this action, okay, it turns out that varying R gives you the Ricci tensor, and varying G gives you the minus a half G mu nu R. Okay, so this turns out to be proportional to the metric variation times the Einstein tensor. Okay? And then, by definition, you say that the action is going to be the action for gravity plus the action for matter. Okay, and then by definition, the variation of the action for matter is going to be the T mu nu. So this, by definition, will be delta S matter. Okay, and that's the other way to derive it, which is much nicer. You just say, I've got to write a generally covariant action. The variation of the gravitational action gives me the Einstein tensor. The variation of the matter action gives me something, which has two indices. And it's symmetric, because Jimmy Neu is symmetric. And that's what I'm going to call the stress energy tensor. And then the sort of miracle is that when you do this, it gives consistent equations of motion. Varying an action doesn't always give consistent equations of motion, right? So for example, if my action is x, and I vary with respect to x, the variation is 1. And I can't set 1 equal to 0. That's inconsistent. So some actions, when you vary them, give, you know, they don't have zero derivative. It's just not possible. So actions do not always give consistent equations of motion. But if they do, then they will give the Einstein equation. So that's a sort of deeper way of doing this. So for example, when Hilbert, I don't know if this is historically accurate, but when Einstein did this, he was guided by physics, and he was guided by this. When Hilbert did it, he would have been guided by the action. And he would say, what's the variation of root gr? Well, it's the Einstein tensor. So Hilbert would have said the only possible way gravity can enter the equation is through the Einstein tensor, because that's the variation of the only generally coordinate action. So it wouldn't have needed to do any of this algebra. Any other questions? Yeah.
So does Jimmy Neu derive from the action principle, is that automatically conserved?
Yes, it is, by a generalization of Noether's theorem, as you might imagine. So any action which is generally coordinate invariant, one can show that the corresponding stress tensor derived this way will be conserved. Okay, I may get to show that near the end of the course, if there's time. Okay, there's no class this afternoon. I guess there's a colloquium on the origin of life. So let me encourage you to go to that.